Well, kia ora tātou, hoi te anō, tēnei te mihi kia koutou, kei ngā rangatira, tuatahi ake koutou Ngāti Wātua, tatuatu rā kia koutou ngā tā, kei Wainganui a tātou me koutou, ngā moana, ngā waituku, ngā kiri, ngā maunga, no ngā tōpito katoa o te ikaroa Māui e takoto nei, tatuatu rā ki te Waipaunamu. Kua kuana te ngākau kua tai mai, mātou toko wā, ki te kōrero kia koutou mō tēnei kaupapa waka ira ira. Nō reira, kia ora tātou. So, kia ora everybody. We were just going to come up and sing the song because Heke has sort of stolen our thunder. But much of what I'm going to discuss today is directly related to what the minister has shared with us this morning. It's customary for me to kick off a presentation. Usually I have my colleague, Tiaki Hunia. I take the ship out, he brings the wreck in. And so this morning I'll take the ship out and then you can judge whether they're bringing a wreck in or not, or we're going to reach our destination, which is our island that we're looking to land on. So I thought what I'd kick off with, I love this particular slide. I actually stole it from Mike Taituku. I don't actually know the origin of it. I know there's a spelling mistake there, I think, if you look at the word commodity. But I think this for me really sums up who we are, who we were, and I think who we could be in the future. And I'm a big believer in learning or renewing ourselves from the lessons of the past. And a big thinker, I sort of like to challenge the status quo and imagine the possibilities. And when I look at this and I reflect and think back to our forebears, our tūpuna who traversed the Pacific, what were they thinking? They imagined the possibilities. The fact that they got in their waka, I know in Taranaki we say that the sort of waka that assisted in pulling up the sort of North Island sits on Taranaki, which is a bit different to the East Coast tradition. But those of our ancestors that traversed the Pacific Ocean, they were risk takers. You had to be. They were innovators. They were entrepreneurs. They developed systems and knowledge which enabled them to succeed, not only where they were. They recognised that they needed to explore and do new things. And when arriving here in Aotearoa, their knowledge systems assisted them in terms of developing ways of living through observation, science, and so on and so forth. So for me, this really sums up who we were. We've sort of lost this at the moment, in my view, but we're beginning to recapture it. But I'm very confident that we can sort of reawaken the spirit of success. And ultimately, that's what I want to talk about today in terms of what success is for us. But I thought, to limit the amount of time I speak, I've got a little video that I'll kick off with now. And this is Professor Kenneth Robertson. Many of you will know this guy. He's on TED Talks and so on and so forth. He's quite famous for his particular lecture about the fact that the education system is basically eroding and eradicating the creative potential of our young people. And in one particular lecture, he talks about a teacher at a school, and I'll call her Lily for the purposes of this particular presentation. The teacher walks up to Lily and says, "Lily, what are you doing?" And Lily says, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And the teacher says to Lily, "But Lily, nobody knows what God looks like." And Lily said to the teacher, "Well, they will in a minute." And I think, you know, when you think about our young people, you know, there's so much creative potential that we can better harness. And I'm really pleased with Heke. I mean, I have a personal view about the current education system. If it's not delivering and working for us, why not try something different? So I thought, here's another piece from Sir Ken.
I came across a great quote recently from Abraham Lincoln, who I thought you'd be pleased to have quoted at this point. He said this in December 1862 to the second annual meeting of Congress. I ought to explain that I had no idea what was happening at the time. We don't teach American history in Britain. We suppress it. You know, this is our policy, so... So no doubt something fascinating was happening in December 1862, which the Americans among us will be aware of. But he said this: "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion." I love that. Not rise to it, rise with it. "As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. I love that word, disenthrall. You know what it means? That there are ideas that all of us are enthralled to, which we simply take for granted as the natural order of things, the way things are. And many of our ideas have been formed not to meet the circumstance of this century, but to cope with the circumstances of previous centuries. But our minds are still hypnotized by them. And we have to disenthrall ourselves of some of them.
So I guess that's where I want to leave things this morning. No. But I think he aptly, you know, it's this whole notion of how we're enthralled by our past, which is important. But I think too often we operate from that historical perspective and position rather than sort of evolving and developing with the present and the future. And, you know, that it's just something that we need to constantly do. And I think that's, if anything, is a message that I want you to think about sort of moving forward. When we look at the particular topic that we're talking about in terms of balancing, you know, the intergenerational needs, this is just, I'm going to fire through a few slides here, our past. I go to a whole lot of conferences where I'm talking to a non-Māori audience and I remind them that Māori established New Zealand as an agricultural exporting nation. There's going to be a prize for anyone who can name after the conference the first person to export butter from New Zealand. It was a Māori man from up north, sent 8 pounds of butter offshore. So some prizes for anyone who can name that particular person. But the important thing here is that we were, in that sort of early contact period, we were totally engaged in commerce and economic activity. We grew our own produce. We had value chains, you know, integrated value chains where we were growing, manufacturing. We owned boats and we were exporting our product into markets, Asia, the Americas, and other places. Unfortunately, because of the result of land loss and mass immigration, and Sir Mason, you talk about the various sort of stages or periods of interaction with the Europeans, we sort of lost that space. Then we had sort of, you know, when the emergence of the protest movements in the 60s, 70s. You know, I think we're at a stage now where we can actually recapture this position where we are fully full participants in the economy. So there's that. And I think from my perspective, there is a shift occurring. Feedback from yesterday, it's really great to reflect on the past and Sir Tamati in terms of your experience, Sir Tipene. You know, it was fascinating to sort of hear the feedback about the fact that the sort of preparation for the Ngaitahu settlement has basically shaped the attitudes and values of the tribe moving forward into the future. Of course, the challenge with that is how we stay in the collaborative space rather than the adversarial space. Settlements have a tendency to sort of divide people, and so our big challenge is to look at how we can work more collaboratively, not only intra-iwi, but inter-iwi. And so there's this, definitely this shift occurring. I'm not going to talk about the Māori economy. The only point I want to make here is probably something different, quite apart from the fact that institutions only make up a small proportion of that particular figure. What you see is the true potential and the greatest asset that we have is our people. Because when you look at that particular, you know, the employer contribution, that is the largest contribution. And so, you know, we've got to focus more on how we lift the capability of our people. We all know the stats here, and I'm sure my learned colleagues here will talk about the fact that, you know, we're still heavily weighted to the three Fs, fishing, farming and forestry. But given the current sort of asset base, there's huge potential for us to further grow and develop in these particular sectors. But for me, this is really what I've been thinking about, having participated in a couple of treaty settlements and chairing an iwi organisation, very much focused on asset development. One of the key shifts, if you like, for me personally, is a recognition that we need to focus more strongly on the well-being of our people and to consider how our assets will actually assist in developing and creating or unlocking that particular potential. Because what we do have, and the statistics tell us, and Tahu will talk about that later in terms of the fact that we're not achieving and performing as well as we could be across the multiple areas of health, education, and so on and so forth. And of course, Hekia touched on the fact that we have a young population, so I think about 24 years is the average age, compared to non-Māori, which is about 37 or 38. And so, you know, again, we need to sort of address some of the challenges that we face in terms of the underachievement within our particular society. And then I'm not going to talk about Māori demographics, because that was really to help Tahu out, who's an expert in this space. But I'm always fascinated by, you know, these facts and figures, and, you know, just the number of people that aren't engaged in any employment or workforce training. Hekia talked about the educational underachievement, the fact that, you know, a lot of our people are working in sectors that are exposed to, you know, sort of the peaks and troughs of the economy. So when the economy is on a sort of a downward turn, you know, high percentage of labourers, machine operators, drivers, and all of those that always are impacted by these particular shocks in the economy. Now, Māori land, now look, a lot of people sort of ask about whether, you know, how correct these particular figures are, and I sort of use it as a bit of a barometer in terms of simply sort of stating and suggesting that we've got some work to do in the Māori land space, and let's view this as an opportunity in terms of what we can achieve moving forward. The fact that give or take 80% is either underperforming or unutilised, and Tracy can provide some insights into this particular picture. Government like to talk about these big headline figures in terms of over a 10-year period, if we're to get the Māori land base working, an extra $10 billion in additional gross output, you know, a huge number of new jobs, increased contribution to GDP. They often forget to actually sort of put in that last bullet point there, that it's going to require a hell of a lot of investment. And so when you look at the $3 billion investment sort of required in broad terms versus the sort of the gain, 3.7, it sort of nets out really. But the positive aspect of this is the fact that there could be employment opportunities. I really sort of put this in for Ma, because, you know, when you think about Ma and I had the pleasure of sitting on an IOD panel in Auckland, and so sort of before the conference, well before, of course, we sat down and sort of thought through what we were going to discuss with the audience that day. But, you know, when you look at the deprivation levels that exist within some of our rural communities, it's alarming. And this is for the East Coast region. You know, that's alarming. I was involved with our iwi on the Chatham Islands, Ngāti Mutunga ki Wairakauri. You know, there, chaired the asset holding company, we had quite a deliberate strategy that focused on how we could invest on island, purely on the basis that if we didn't have an island economy, we didn't have a community. If we didn't have a community, we don't have an iwi. And so I think, you know, in a sense, we need to rethink the way in which we approach investment. And so my sort of, my message, if you like, if I was to be a preacher, is the fact that we are in the waka together. And I say together as Māori, as iwi, but also as Māori and non-Māori, because we, in my view, cannot do it alone. And there's a number of reasons. Capital constraints is one. That's both in human and financial terms. The fact is, with the sectors that we have a heavy interest in, we're still sort of occupying the producer space. Now, if we think about the fact that many of our iwi are not inclined or do not have a view to sell land or quota, for example, it's therefore a game of free cash flow rather than capital gains. So how do you capture greater economic rents from assets? One, as an asset holder, but you need to sort of move along the value chain towards the market. So how do we do that? It requires us to collaborate, work together to build scale. And I think the last point there, it's, you know, and why must we do this? Because I think when we look at it, our rural communities are dependent on us succeeding in these particular areas. So our success in commercial terms is directly linked to our success as communities and as a society. So I sort of say we have something to offer. So I've been involved in the three boot camps over in Stamford. I sort of call myself a third year fifth there. And it was quite fascinating, and I know that Steve Mahari sort of opened the conference, and, you know, the amazing thing about this sort of movement is you expose some of our non-Māori brethren to the way in which we think and our values, and the things we take for granted are so so appreciated by those outside of New Zealand, and I think those non-Māori New Zealanders are starting to get a deeper appreciation for that. And Taki was telling me that Steve Mahari yesterday opened his conference by saying that, you know, our future is about sort of seeing ourselves through our mokopuna's eyes, and those sorts of things are starting to emerge in the consciousness of our non-Māori counterparts. So in my view, it's Māori ink plus New Zealand ink. It's all about Aotearoa ink. And I think, you know, we're focused on the Māori economy, and that's good, I think, to sort of look at how we are sort of tracking and performing. But the reality is we need new solutions as a country. And I'm a believer that those new solutions will come from Māori, for reasons that we all know. Governance must support this, but this is really about leadership. And I'll talk briefly about Te Tumu Paero and the organisation I run, but I keep saying to my staff, they say, you know, what's our role? And I said, well, our role is to inspire our people to have higher aspirations for their land and assets. And I said, well, how do I do that? And I said, well, in order to inspire others, we need to be inspired ourselves. And so it's really about sort of lifting those aspirations and expectations of our people to want more. And, of course, with that comes some challenges as well. So Māori success. I mean, ultimately, you know, you can say, well, what does Māori success look like? Well, ultimately, it's about what individuals think success is for them. At an individual level, at a wānau level, whether it be at a marae, apu and iwi level. But I think, you know, I sort of got this statement from Adrian Orr, the redhead Cook Islander that was raised in Taupo. And we went to MFAT one day and we were speaking, and the topic of discussion was about the future of the Pacific Islands. And John Allen rang me up and says, look, I'd like you to come along and talk to my senior management team. I said, fantastic, because I'll just talk about the Māori economy. 3 days out, one of his staff members come along and say, I want you to talk about the Pacific. I said, but I don't know anything about the Pacific. But sort of fortunately, Adrian was there. We were talking about what success looks like for Pacific peoples and there, and what does success look like for Māori. And I think this sort of aptly for me describes it. So having sufficient economic security to be able to participate in and choose from all consumer and investor options available. In so doing, to choose to identify culturally as Māori, as iwi, as a Ngāti Mutunga, as a Ngāti Parau, as a Ngaitahu, or whomever you identify with. So I think, you know, for me it's really about reframing success, and I know yesterday there was a discussion on the quadruple bottom line and the sort of economic stuff, cultural stuff, social, environmental, and whatever that means. And I think, you know, in a sense, individual communities will have a view as to what those things mean. And I think when I look at it in terms of reframing the success, you know, each of these circles are dependent on one another. You know, a lot of economists say cultures come and go. The environment, economic success is important. You know, all of these sort of things I've been thinking about recently. And this notion of kaitiakitanga. I think we need to reframe kaitiakitanga in our present sort of context and in the future, because for many, kaitiakitanga is doing nothing. And that's sort of not good enough, in my view. You know, we care for the environment, so we're not going to do anything. We're going to let our land sort of lie and not utilise it to benefit our people. So I think it's really for us to think about these things in a modern context. Māori asset ownership, this has been something that I've thought about for a bit. Had a lot of conversations with my cousin Tom McClurg from the Chatham Islands around, you know, the fact that for many, our land and our quota is deemed to be a perpetual asset, a taonga asset, that we're not willing to sell. So what does that mean? What is the appropriate return one should expect from an asset that we're not willing to put at risk? Or what does risk look like or management look like when we look to control and influence these particular asset classes? What does a taonga asset look like within a diversified portfolio of other assets? You know, what's the appropriate risk that one should sort of look at when managing taonga assets? All of these sorts of things. And, you know, perpetual ownership, what does it actually mean? But it's fair to say that the attitudes and values of current generations shape the views and perspectives of these perpetual assets as we move forward. And I always sort of challenge people, well, why did our people leave the islands if land was so important? Or then you put another counterfactual, well, if we're intergenerational and we're going to be here forever, can you let go of it for a while and pick it up in 50 years' time? So all of these sorts of things are worthy of further conversation, I think. But certainly, you know, there is a view that if you have a tong or asset, I've talked to Whaimutu Jews and we've had a debate about what the appropriate return should be on a piece of land that's sort of sliding away into some of the waterways on the east coast. He'd say at a basic level it should generate sufficient income to cover the rates. So what's that, a 0.5% return on your asset? Non-Māori? That's a bit high, Ma. 0.25% maybe. But, you know, these are sort of worthy conversations to have. And then you look at it from a Western point of view in terms of some of the endowment funds, so Harvard and what Mr. Swenson and others are doing in terms of diversified portfolios and having particular asset classes which have functions in terms of income, growth and hedging against volatility and all of those sorts of things. But when I look at this particular statement that James Tobin came up with in 1974, in a sense this is our challenge as Māori in terms of being guardians of the future against the claims of the present. And that's really a lot our role. When you think about iwi stewards, those that are managing assets, those that are making decisions today, what the impact and consequence of today's decisions will have on our future generations. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. Now, sort of moving forward, I'm going to give you a quick insight in terms of Te Tumu Paero, the organisation that I'm involved in. So, you know, there's 1.5 million hectares of Māori freehold land throughout the country. Ma's father, Dr. Apirana Mahuika, would say, Jamie, you've left a whole chunk of our land out. And I said, what's that? He said, the Dock Estate. That's Māori land too. And so, you know, it's likely to be a lot more. And this doesn't include, of course, general land owned by Māori, because this is just Māori freehold land. But so at Te Tumu Paero, and it's quite interesting, really. So when I came in 3 years ago in about 9 days, I only know this because I sent a note out to my staff. A lot of them were waiting for the next email, which was saying I was going to sort of be resigning and handing in my notice. But I gave them some reflections after 3 years. And when I came into the role of Māori trustee, it's quite interesting because we've got 2,000 entities, trusts, companies, joint ventures. We have 95,000 owners, which is about just under 20% of the Māori population. We receive $10 million from the government. So if you look at that purely on the basis of dividing $10 million divided by 95,000 owners, it works out to about $105 an owner in terms of us providing services to them. We've got 204,000 ownership interests. And, of course, fragmentation is continuing. And then we look at our portfolio, 100,000 hectares of land. A lot of economists would say, wow, you know, what's the value of the assets that you administer? I said, it's probably about $1.1, $1.2 billion. And they said, that's fantastic, you should promote that. And I said, well, no, not really, not when it's only generating 1.64%. So that's our challenge in terms of how we lift the economic performance of that asset base. But for many of our owners, it's not necessarily about economic returns. So we came up with a new name, Te Tumu Paero. There's a sort of a link here, Paero. So I think it's really about, I came in and I had people, I'd turn up to a hui and people would get up and say, in 1952, Jamie, you did this to me. I said, geez, that's about 20 years before I was born, but you accept that because it was the first time for many that they'd sort of come face to face with the Māori trustees, so they'd have a good crack at you. And I recognise that, you know, Māori trustee, I know around my dinner table in Taranaki and Uranui, it was a kanga, it was a bit of a swear word, so, and I know there's a few Taranaki people in the house here, you know, it was sort of perceived as facilitating the further alienation of those lands that had been returned post-confiscation. And so, you know, we didn't have a kind view of this organisation. So when I went to my old people and said, hey, look, I got a phone call from Wellington to put my name in for this position, and I've been through the process and it's highly likely I'm going to get the role. What do you think? They said, don't take it, boy. You know, one, it's the government. Two, they've done all of these things to us. And, you know, and we need you back here in Taranaki. I basically said to them, well, the end of the day is that the only way you affect change is get in there and change things. And change is quite difficult, challenging. Transformation is never an easy process. But number one, I realised we needed to rebrand ourselves. And so I chose Te Tumu Paero. Now, a tumu is a pillar or a po or a mooring post. And that sort of speaks of strength, solidarity, and a place where we can connect and unite and collaborate. And Paido, of course, is just having an eye to the future, similar to the name of this conference. And then we came up with our vision. And I'm sort of a big believer now in having a clear vision. I think, you know, nō te kingi tanga te kōrero, ki te kahore he waka kitenga, ka ngaro te iwi. You know, that if you don't have vision, you will be lost. And so we wanted to create a vision that could resonate not only internally with our staff, but also with our landowners. So it was about mobilising Māori land and assets to create this generation's legacy, mobilise us to take action, to move, to work together, this generation's legacy, because at the end of the day, if we don't make the right or good decisions today, they will have an impact on our future generations. But the other thing is, we can't change a lot of the things that have happened in the past. We just need to acknowledge, accept, and move forward. And then I look at this particular vision statement through the Māori lens, the old waka analogy, we like that. So, utaina te waka, which literally means to load, prepare our canoe for our journey. Hapainga ko te hoi, as my old people said, well, boy, if you're on the waka and you've got the paddle, use it. So that's the action statement. Kia tupu tupu te whai oranga is all about the enduring legacy that we can leave for our future generations. We have three pou to our strategy: connect with our people, capitalise and grow. On the connect front, as I said, 95,000 owners living in 37 countries around the world. You go to some rural communities who say if he's an absentee owner, he has no rights, we don't care about them. Others say, well, actually, no, they're part of the whānau, they're entitled to be engaged with in relation to their land. So we're moving away from brown envelopes to the digital age. I've said to my guys that, you know, we want to be a digital by default strategy, move into the new world. We've got a big project happening at the moment creating portals for owners called My Whenua. Capitalise our assets. So we've got 100,000 hectares of land. How well is it performing against economic, social and cultural benchmarks that are set by the aspirations of the owners? This is a bridge that we helped to put in place. Now you'd say, well, why'd you put a photo of a bridge up? It took 25 years. But the beautiful thing is they've got their bridge. But actually through this particular process, and it's a bit ironic, you know, building this bridge, it actually brought their people together to learn more about the history of the land and to think about what they want for the future. This house here is Hinemihi, Petania. This is not far from where Tracy's from. So this is basically where Tūwhareto intersects with Ngāti Maniapoto. Fantastic story relating to this particular whare. The owners here, of course, want to refurbish their house, so we've helped them to get a bit of a plan in place. I've said to a lot of people, geez, I don't know, auntie, I think, you know, the house has been let go a bit. But, you know, they've got a clear aspiration to refurb their house. Now, this house and this land is connected to Puhiwahine, Kaeke ki Wairaka. So, you know, you go in, and this is the beauty of the stories. You know, it might be, for some, a dilapidated house and, you know, just a piece of land, but with it comes the interaction and experience of our forebears, our tūpuna, and the present. Funnily enough, the house was twice as long, and one of the kuia was telling me that there were two brothers, couldn't agree. So they cut the house in half. One brother put half on a barge and barged it down the river and set up camp further down the river. But again, so, you know, when I look at this particular piece of land, the owner aspirations aren't about economic, you know, success. It's all about that cultural element in terms of refurbishing this house. But in the future, this may be a virtual house in terms of te ware kōrero o e nida. And so we're hoping to share those stories through the technology platform we're using. And then we're looking at the growth opportunities, recognising that for Māori to succeed, we require, collaboration, building scale, looking at new land use. You know, if you view land as a perpetual asset, the fact that you might have dairy cows on it for the next 2-3 decades is a means to an end to achieve economic success. Land is land. You know, my uncles sort of back home say, geez, you know, you're coming here, boy, to tell us that we should be leaving the Manuka. We spend our lifetime cutting this stuff down. And so looking at that, dairy goats, really good. You can have a viable dairy goat farm on 50 hectares. And so, you know, that's a viable proposition for a lot of our Māori land blocks. The other thing, it has a lower environmental footprint, so positive in terms of the environmental aspects. Kiwi fruit have really unlocked a huge amount of potential in Te Kaha. 2 hectare land blocks are now generating, you know, 150,000 net per hectare a year, providing employment and so on and so forth. So, you know, the mobilising Māori assets, it requires commitment. So I think my message is let's stop the rhetoric about a long-term strategy and commit to it. Collaboration, you know, we tend to talk about collaboration, and we've got to sort of, you know, start acting, and the capital and capability are things we all know about. We did have another video, but I think time's ticking on, so I'll just go to the...
The story of Te Ruo Te Moko started with 4 ahuwhenua trusts, which were previously independently managed. In 2007, through the efforts of Māori trustee, and in particular Anne Marie Broughton and Navina McGuckin, an idea was generated.
Well, my first call was to Daisy Noble, and I explained to her that I thought there was an opportunity to bring all 5 blocks together and create a dairy farm. She said, just go for it.
First and foremost, this whenua was hapu whenua. Prior to the confiscations that happened in Taranaki. In 1863, Taranaki experienced Crown presence. And they burnt our whenua. That's what they did to us. This project helps to put us back onto the landscape.
What's happened here is essentially an exchange for their land, which they still own. They've received share capital. This was prorated on an independently valued basis, and so essentially that's their ownership in Te Ruo Te Moko.
Te Ruo Te Moko Limited is a farm of 189 hectares. 170 hectares is effective in the business, and we're currently milking 500 Kiwi Cross cows on that platform. We are looking to grow the size of our herd to 570 cows by the 2018-19 season, and increasing production from excess of 200,000 milk solids to 235,000 milk solids.
Got all our waterways are fenced, and around 85% of them are planted.
The owners always had an aspiration for our own people to be farming our land, and so instead of just waiting for someone to do it for us, we decided that we'd do it ourselves, and so we created a farm training school. We have 8 cadets that are currently being trained. Last year in 2013, we had 8 cadets that were both trained, accredited, and are now gainfully employed.
I started here at the training farm at Te Ruo Te Moko with the land-based training. I learned everything from my tutor, Chris Morrison. I'm working now at Pātai Dairy Farm in Waitotara, milking 1,100 cows on a 400 hectare farm. I just love working outdoors with all the cows, just everything about dairy farming.
The dairy industry is a good place for young New Zealanders to get stuck in. It's one of the few careers that you can become your own boss reasonably quickly, and your money-making potential never ends.
The story of some passionate owners who had a dream, they went about getting everyone together that they needed, got everyone on the same page, and that brought Te Ruo Te Moko to life. In some challenging circumstances, the trust had planned well and attracted the right people into the business at all levels, and the execution has been excellent. There's been good financial performance year on year with a focus on free cash flow. The innovative creation of a performance scorecard that the board could use that had both lead and lag indicators, so the board knew exactly not only what the farm had been doing, but what they could expect it to be doing going forward.
So I think the reason why I sort of chose Te Ruo Te Moko was the fact that the leadership and owners of those land blocks had a vision, and they just did it. I mean, they went about creating an opportunity to reconnect their people back on the land. But the other thing is that it is an exemplar of what can be achieved with good vision and leadership. And, you know, they're going to sort of only go forward from here. So sort of in conclusion for me, I think I'm quite positive about the future. And I think we all need to be optimistic. I think we can all sort of contribute to the ongoing vitality of our various iwi or Māori economic authorities. Ultimately, it's about, you know, inspiring our current generations to want sort of higher aspirations and increased expectations, and for us individually to think about the legacy that we will leave for our mokopuna. And of course, you know, Hiki has spoken about the investment in workforce capability. But it's really about the role of leadership and inspired leadership to create vision for our people. And I think all of you in the room here today have the opportunity to play a role and a part in doing that. So kia ora tātou.